Radio. This is Pet Life Radio. Let's talk pets.
Yes, everybody, you know the drill. We've started this podcast to help anyone who is remotely interested in trapping and neutering animals. We're the help we didn't receive when we first wanted to get involved, and we want to be your new besties in the TNR world. I'm Alex, one of your hosts for this ride, and I'm so grateful to have Adele by my side. Hey, Adele.
Hi, Alex. How you doing today?
I'm a little bit sick, so I hope we can't hear it too much from my voice, but I just got back from Mexico, so I'm back in the cold of Vancouver.
Yeah, you did a lot of cool things in Mexico. We talked a little bit about that in the last 2 weeks.
You guys should check out the last two episodes because I helped Coco's Animal Welfare and Pet Project Rescue. We went on a big TNR and spay and neuter mission in Playa del Carmen, and it was really amazing. So you guys check out the last two episodes.
And today we're going all the way to the other side of the world, to Coimbatore, India, where we're talking to Minnie. Hi, Minnie. Thanks for joining us.
Hello. Hi. Very privileged to be there in this group today. Thank you.
Yeah, it's really nice to have you. So just a little bit about Minnie. Minnie is an engineer by profession, but also the co-founder and managing trustee of Coimbatore City NGO, Humane Animal Society. She strongly believes that making a difference isn't as important as making a living. And really cool, is a recipient of the Nari Shakti Purushkar, the highest civilian honor for women in India. That's a huge recognition of your work.
Whoa,
in the
yeah.
field of animal welfare.
Thank you. Thank you.
You've also earned a doctorate in electrical engineering from the University of Texas and is a recognized inventor with several patents to your credit in the field of wireless telecommunication engineering. So not only are you an incredibly compassionate person, but an incredibly imaginative, educated, inventive person. So really excited to hear about how all these things have come together for animal welfare.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. And wonderful to participate in this, podcast. And hopefully we can reach more people who can help more animals. You know, that's the whole ambition that I have, you know, and to be a world where no animal has to suffer, you know.
Exactly. That's the goal, to help people help animals, because that's what we all want. And so, Minnie, we'd like to ask our guest a question to just gently start the conversation. When did you first start being caring about animal rights? What happened?
Yeah, it's a, you know, as long as I can remember, from an early childhood, I would say I was always connected with animals. I always felt connected, but it didn't really truly translate into being activism or being an activist, or you know, and or you know, being very conscious about my actions per se. However, I could relate to suffering of animals from a very young age, and I used to be able to you know, probably relate to how they felt, and felt very comfortable in their presence. For example, my grandparents lived in a farm in a village, and whenever we used to go on vacations, there were, you know, many animals living with them, and that was one of my early exposures where I was in very close proximity with animals.
Yeah,
one of the incidents that truly probably made a very deep impact in my life was, a particular incident where a neighbor came out of the house and had this, chicken just lifted from the ground. They were all, you know, and with a swift motion of the knife, just had the head severed. And while holding the head in the hand, the bird fell down, and the bird was flapping her wings.
Oh my God.
His wings. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a male. I mean, a cock that was being severed, and I can remember what went through me. It was very shocking, and lot of thoughts just went through me at the time. I was an 11-year-old child, just witnessing it, and it left a very deep impact because we used to eat chicken at home, and the fact that what is on your table is related to a life and what that life meant, and what that life meant for that individual was something, you know, it struck me in a very brutal fashion. That was probably one of the first turning points in my life. I just remembered running into the house and telling that, you know, I will never ever touch animal on my plate. I will never have a animal as part of my food. And so I stopped. I just turned vegetarian overnight. I mean, the whole concept of being vegan and all that was not very very much visible to me. And in India, you know, we live in India, and there is cow is considered like, you know, cow gives you milk, and it's considered as like a, you know, an offer. I mean, that's what the cow gives you. And even in schools, people learn that cow gives you milk. It's like your mother. So those were all thoughts that were totally lost on me. That was cruel as well. But, you know, I turned vegetarian overnight. And even though people around me felt that it was a, you know, reaction to a traumatic incident that would not last very long, it truly, you know, what you call, strengthened with every passing day. And probably my whole life of being connected with animals got a very strong foundation from that point. And I turned vegetarian, like I stopped eating fish. And, you know, it's from a coastal village in Kerala where, you know, fish is like a staple diet. Every day you have fish. So I stopped eating fish and meat, chicken, you know, overnight. And that was truly a turning point. Yeah, so after that, over the years, I've always been more conscious. My vegan journey, the beginning of my vegan journey could have been there at the point. But for me to become a fully vegan, it took several years. And, you know, it was after many years that I turned completely vegan.
Yeah, Amber. So Amber, the co-founder of Saving Lives, went to see Minnie a couple months ago. I think it was back in November. And she was so happy to find a rescue shelter that has a vegan option and that was run by a vegan person, because it's not always the case. And I remember she was raving about it, and she was so happy. Yeah, like she raved about you, but also the fact that you were vegan really, yeah, struck her. So that was really nice.
Yeah, truly, that was the best decision in my life ever. I mean, going vegan, nothing can beat it. I think that's probably the most significant decision and the best decision ever I've made in my life.
Can you tell us a bit more about the Human Animal Society that you run? Can you tell us a bit more how you started it and how you run it?
Yeah. So hi, yeah. So I was like any other person who and also probably a little kind of an overachiever from an early childhood, always been good at academics, do well, but I always had a sensitive side to me. I can always remember that suffering really moved me, and I wherever I lived, wherever I was, always tried to be kind and helpful, mostly for, I've always had animals as one of my priorities. So starting Humane Animal Society was never part of my agenda. And just that I was always helpful to animals, and I tried to be of use wherever I was. I used to volunteer while I lived in the US, and I've always, tried to be of any assistance to an animal in distress. Other than that, I did not have any plan to start an organization in India. But we lived in America from the early 90s until early 2000s. 2004 is when we moved to Coimbatore. And for some reason, I mean, like over a period of time, of course, you have changed yourself, your exposure, you as a person has transformed in the way you consciously think about everything around you. And I found so many animals just immeasurably suffering on the streets. And the fact that there wasn't any organized effort in the city, there weren't people who really were concerned about it and even thought, you know, had spared a thought about what to do, that really disturbed me. And it was quite a very, very disturbing period of my life where I used to think, what's the point in us living our life like thinking just about ourselves as humans, but not, you know, concerned about the environment, concerned about so many sentient creatures suffering every day on the streets and, you know, just ignoring them, turning your face away and going. And it just didn't seem right at all. So I strongly felt that, you know, we must do something about it. And that is how the seed of Humane Animal Society was born. And I had also, you know, adopted a pet while I was living in the US who came along with us back to India. And I saw him in every animal that I saw on the street. And I just felt, you know, I mean, they deserve an equally happy life, just like how Max is living with me, you know, and there is no reason why they have to suffer. And it's a discrimination that was, I felt very strongly, which is unjustified. And that is how Humane Animal Society was born. I and my husband, we said, you know, let us just at least, you know, start a small, you know, group of people, like-minded people, bring them together and, you know, see what best we could do to help an animal if we saw suffering on the street. It was not like we thought, you know, we would do so much at the time. We just felt that, you know, it would be possible to, you know, if like we ever came across an animal suffering, we should be able to do something about it. And we should not think that we are helpless and we can't do anything. So that thought of being unable to help an animal shouldn't exist. So that was truly the motivation to start Humane Animal Society. It started as a very, very small 3 to 4 people. And, you know, we were brainstorming, you know, what do we do next when we see an animal suffering? How do we go about? What are the steps we can do? So that is the origin. That was in the year 2006 when we registered the organization in Coimbatore. And we had a small, you know, what you call a bylaws and, you know, what are the objectives and so on. I mean, we do a lot of research into it, but it's the first time and it was not like something, you know, we were all experienced with. So, and a lot of bureaucracy in India about getting an organization set up. So we went through all the early pangs of growth and birth and growth, you know, for the organization.
Yeah. So to your point, talking about the different ways to help, not only is HAS a shelter, but also provides some medical care and things like that to animals, but you also run a dog population management program. Could you tell us a little bit more about that specifically and what that looks like and what your day-to-day looks like running that program?
Okay. So the spay-neuter program was not new to me because I lived abroad and, you know, spay-neuter is part of the culture, right? I mean, companion animals are always spayed neuter before adoption. That's part of the protocol and to prevent unwanted proliferation. But here, you know, that was non-existent. There was no spay neuter program in the city. And there was a new official rule that came in the state of Tamil Nadu that, you know, municipalities and panchayats and all these bodies, local bodies must start something like this because straight up, you know, problem was quite serious. A lot of complaints were coming up and so on. So the government decided that they should do something and then they started a small center. So now when the center started, I was very interested because I, you know, this is where you truly can make a difference. There's the number of animals, the less animals that are there on the streets, the less suffering that they have and the better life that they can lead. So I thought, you know, I must go and try and see, you know, what I could do to help out this program. What saw me really shocked, you know, everything out of me because it was run in a very, very primitive way, in a very poor fashion, without aseptic protocols and, you know, no procedures. And it was done in a very, very, you know, unorganized and unprofessional manner. So the reason why I probably felt very strongly about it was because of my having been, you know, seen good centers run properly. And I complained and I made a big hue and cry about it. And what eventually happened was the whole center got thrust on us. And so that was also something we never expected. It was not something we planned to have because we were very just starting. We didn't even have basic ideas about how to run. I mean, of course, I knew what Spain YouTube was. I knew how it was done, but it was not. None of us were proficient in doing it, and we were not experienced. And then the center got thrust on us and then started a whole new journey of how the Spain YouTube program should be run professionally, bringing, expertise, training our staff, training our vets, one by one, building blocks like one stone at a time, training one person at a time, we had one vet and one helping staff. That's how we started the Spain YouTube program. So yeah, it was a huge, huge challenge, but we did it and we didn't give up, which was really something I'm very, very proud of today, because coming to think of it, I just don't know how. I just had, maybe I was young and restless and must have been raring to okay, fine, let's take this on. So that is how it ended up the center got stuck with us, and we started to run it. And we started to run it professionally. The whole nine yards of running a ladies.
I mean, it's a huge amount of work to establish your own project like that, especially with a center. So much goes along with that. Are you today, are you mostly focusing on dogs? Are you having your own staff go out and catch them who have been trained on that? And then they're bringing them to your center and they're being sterilized. What does that look like? How many animals would you be dealing with on a daily basis? Or is this more of a once a week kind of thing?
No, it's a daily thing. It's a daily thing. And we have a program where we also work with communities. In India, as you know, there is, of course, there are three types of dog population. So the animal that we work mostly with are still dogs. We do a lot of spay neuter for cats as well, but predominantly it's dogs, and it's a stray population in the city, which is the primary target. However, I would like to make a distinction between among the three type of dogs that are there. So the first category is the pet category, which everybody knows. Okay, it's a pet dog, your pet dog at home. That's one category. Then you have the community dog category, which is, they're not owned, but they're not truly stray, because they do have people caring for them. They do get food. They are supervised in a very, very superficial way. And people do care for them. If one of them fell sick or is not eating, that someone would, immediately raise an alarm and try to, find a vet who can come and, treat, something like that. So that's the category. And then the last, which is the most prevalent one, is the street dog population that is, free roaming. They are not owned by anybody. They are they have a free, run, everywhere. They get, the waste food that is available on the streets. And some people, if they are kind enough, they will probably put some food here, there, but they're not really supervised. So our primary target is the street dog population, because they are the ones who suffer the most. So we target them in terms of catching. So every day we do catch about 10 to 15 dogs. We bring them the previous day, the lot that was caught the previous day will be the ones that will be operated on that one particular day. So if yesterday we caught 15 dogs, those will be the dogs that will be operated today. And the ones we catch today would be operated tomorrow. So because we keep them overnight, because they have to be fasting before the surgery, and that will also give us some time to observe them to see if they're caught from the streets. So, they might have some underlying condition which you didn't know. At least, that gives us some time to observe them to see, how active they are. Are they really sick, or are they showing any signs of distress? So it will give us some time to do that. So we do surgeries on all 6 days of the week. Sundays, usually we don't do spay neuter surgeries unless there is an emergency or there is a special surgery. We do it. So in a month, approximately we do around 250 to 300 spay neuter surgeries, including dogs, cats, community dogs, free roaming as well. So that is the kind of thing. And apart from that, we also do rescue rehabilitation as well, because there will be emergency calls for rescuing. So we have a it also serves as a trauma center. Our animal birth control center also serves as a trauma center. And apart from that, we also have a sanctuary, which is where Amber and Ollie actually volunteered. That is a place where we have a permanent residence over there whom we can't release back after we have rescued them. They would have, you know, undergone some major surgery or some condition which will prevent them from leading a normal life outside on the streets, so which makes them vulnerable, and which results in us having to keep them for life at the sanctuary. So we have a sanctuary which is separate from the ABC and trauma center, which is away from the city. And we have about 150 animals over there, mostly dogs and some cats, pony, two cows, and all that. And so we don't do a lot of rescue for large animals, mostly primarily because we don't have the space for it and we don't have the resources for it.
And it's not sustainable.
Not sustainable as well. And also we do spot treatment for large animals outside. On the streets we do it, and sometimes we have people call us when an animal, a lot of animals are just left on the streets by people who own them, and there is no responsibility. And if we find a large animal like a cow or a donkey or a pony suffering on the streets, we do go there and do some spot treatment, try to find a safe place for the animal. But we can't do rescues, and keep them with us for life. That is almost impossible. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you've said it yourself, to be able to spay and neuter up to 300 animals a month, that means you have to keep away from rescue as much as possible. You have so many animals coming through your facility and just have 150 residents. I mean, that's a huge indication that you're trying your best to manage the balance between rescue and prevention, especially being in a place surrounded by so many animals, whether you're in a really urban environment or in the countryside, and also being aware of all species like you guys are. Do you have any tips for how you approach the balance between rescue and prevention? When I saw in your stories earlier today that you posted something from Paws for a Cause, our friends in Delhi NCR, to try to find a home for some animals there. So obviously, like, you are thinking about, you know, trying to approach rescue and rehoming. How do you balance that with prevention, spay and neuter vaccination, things like that?
Yeah, it's a huge challenge, actually, because, a rescue call comes, it takes precedence, and the reason being that it's between life and death for the animal, and it is also the care you can give as soon as you if the animal has met with an accident, that is probably the most critical period of time. So we have to sometimes drop everything we do, and we have to immediately rush for rescues. So over a period of time, we do have different sets of people who do it. We are able to hire more people who can, who are good with handler, being able to handle a animal in distress, because it's not easy all the time to go and rescue an animal from the street. I mean, and of course you have an overwhelming desire to do it. The animal is in pain and can bite you and can cause a lot of problems with the people around and creating chaos all around. So you need to have a very calm, balanced set of people who know what to do, remain calm, try to make the animal calm, try to handle the animal in a humane fashion, and safely transport the animal to a place where it is possible to treat. So yeah, it is a huge challenge. We struggle to balance. I mean, if you're asking whether we balance it, we don't balance it very well. That fact is, we don't. And I wish I could tell differently, that we have a separate trauma center with separate everything, separate. I mean, hopefully one day we may be able to run an exclusively spay neuter program that doesn't interfere with the rescue rehab, and we can run separately. But as of now, that's not the case.
Can I ask you some more questions about your sterilization program? At what age do you sterilize kittens and puppies? What are your requirements?
Yeah, so if it's a street animal that was, you know, we find, we generally assess the health, and we don't spay neuter very young animals. I mean, in the US, 2 months, it's like, you know, they spay neuter them. But we normally, for dogs, we generally, you know, we wait until 5 to 6 months for both male and female. And for male, usually when the testicles descend, we operate. That is what we use as a criteria for doing for males. And for females, it's usually 5 to 6 months. For cats, it's a little earlier. We normally do it at around approximately 4 months. The same thing. I mean, these days, cats are like really very prolific. They start to breed very early and they come on heat very quickly. So we have also started to adapt that, and we do that with the age thing. We have also started to do a little bit more scientific ways of, you know, doing a blood test before we actually do the spay neuter program, which we were not able to do for a very long time due to lack of resources and also the time that it takes, you know. And the earlier we are able to finish the surgery and release the dog back, the better it is, because the animal is back in its territory, they're happy there. So keeping an animal in a confined space always is very stressful, and it prevents healing, it prevents the emotional well-being. So a lot of those aspects will need to be considered. So we try to release them, you know, on the fourth day after the surgery. For the suture site is fine, we check the basic, you know, the scoring of the site, and also to make sure the animal starts to eat well and, you know, active and showing signs. And generally, when the dogs go back, they are actually much, much more happier, and they actually integrate into the environment very quickly. So we try to do that to the extent possible.
Can I ask what blood tests you're doing beforehand? Is it just a general CBC for their general health, or are you also testing for any infectious disease?
So right now it's just only CBC. We just do CBC to make sure that, you know, the basic parameters are right, platelets are okay, the hemoglobin and all that's fine, dog is not suffering from it. But, you know, strictly speaking, we should actually do run a full blood test, because there could be underlying kidney issues and liver issues which may not show up on a simple CBC. So we don't do the entire spectrum unless, you know, it is a case where we strongly feel that there is something that we must check. And also if a dog that is caught is showing some, you know, abnormal symptoms or showing something that is suggestive of some underlying condition, then we definitely will run a full panel test.
I think that's pretty normal, though, for a lot of us running these programs, is to not do infectious disease tests before unless you see some indication of illness, to the point you made before of generally lack of resources. I mean, most people don't even do a general CBC blood test because of lack of resources. So it's understandable. There are a lot of things I'm sure we all would like to do more if we could, but, you know, resources are a huge limiting factor.
Yes, and absolutely. And also the numbers, right? And the number that we would like to target, we want to target as many numbers as possible. And then, you know, every test that you do, actually, you know, it adds time and adds the thing. And normally the Indian street dogs, they are extremely robust. I mean, they're naturally bred over generations. And very rarely we come across a situation where, you know, a dog had actually, you know, had a problem. And most of the Indian dogs, you know, are genetically very diverse, right? I mean, they are extremely robust. So, you know, to a large extent, it kind of justifiable, but we have started doing CBC now for more cases, you know, because we felt we have the resources to do it now. We have the more funding to enable us to be procured the, you know, the CBC machine in our lab. In our own lab, we don't have to send the blood out for testing, which used to be a huge challenge, you know, sending the lab work somewhere else, waiting for the results, paying so much money. So we have got a lot of things in-house now, so which has, you know, helped us a lot in moving forward in a better, more scientific way.
We need to take a quick break, but we'll be back with more insights from Minnie.
to hear more of your favorite show? Full episodes of all our shows are available on demand. Go to PetLifeRadio.com to fetch our entire lineup of Possum Pet Podcasts. Also, dig us up in iHeartRadio and iTunes. Let's Talk Pets. Live and on demand, only from Pet Life Radio. Let's Talk Pets.
Let's Talk Pets.
On Pet Life Radio.
Pet Life Radio.
PetLifeRadio.com.
And we're back with Mini from Animal Human Society of Combator. Trying to pronounce it right. Mini, what are some local attitudes or beliefs about sterilization and vaccination of community animals? Have you found it hard to convince local to bring animals to be sterilized?
Yeah, early days, it was a huge challenge. First of all, the community and local people felt it was very unnatural, you know, and they attach a lot of anthropocentric values, you know, in the sense that, you know, like, you know, this is why would you want to like remove the ability for an animal to procreate? That is a sin. So early days, we faced a lot of resistance when we were, especially with community animals, they were very protective and saying, okay, I would like this dog to give birth. That's its right. And but they did not have an answer for suffering. So when I pointed out that, you know, that there is so much suffering because of it, and wouldn't you rather go a path that is less, causes less suffering? So it took a while, but today, you know, I can tell you that there has been a sea change in the attitude of people. And today people, you know, stand in line. We have more requests than what we can handle, you know, the dogs that are coming for sterilization and vaccinations. And the knowledge about vaccination, for example, was very, very low. And a lot of people in India, even today, people feel that the Indian dogs don't need vaccination. Though they don't need, only the breed the purebred pets need vaccination. And the Indian dogs don't need vaccination. So it is some, you know, kind of a conditioned belief. There's no reason for it, but it has been passed along a generation. And I even know families that have a purebred dog and an indie dog, and they will vaccinate the purebred dog regularly, but not vaccinate the indie dog. Saying, it doesn't need vaccination. So it is so much of that kind of bias is there in terms of, you know, seeing the need for a dog to be vaccinated. But today, there are a lot of changes now. And it is 19 years since we started, and it is a long time. We just celebrated our 19th year of inception of the organization. And I can see that there has been a huge change in the attitudes, mindsets, and community people, the kind of, you know, responsibility that they're taking, and people who are feeding. A person who feeds always, you know, in India, food is like very important. I mean, like, you know, you know, starving or not having a meal is considered like a very, very bad thing, you know, for humans. And so, you know, they attribute the same thing for animals too. And, this animal needs to be fed. But then, you know, feeding comes with a huge responsibility. So I said, if you just feed a dog and keep feeding and don't take care of its sterilization and vaccination, so what you end up having is this dog giving birth, you know, every cycle, and you end up having, like, you know, millions of puppies, and some of them getting run over, some of them suffering, some of them not even making it. So that, you know, educating community, creating awareness, education has always been a big part of our work. And right from beginning, we focused a lot on that, which has reaped huge benefits. And educating communities, wherever we go, we sit there, we try to explain. If someone visits the center, we try to explain to them how, you know, better you can take care of the street animals. And then they say, you know, I have seen this dog, you know, I've seen this dog every single day, and this dog is having this huge wound. And I'm like, this is where you can help, you know. You don't have to think you can't help, because we are here to help you, and you have to support us in terms of coordinating the rescue. We don't even want you to, you know, give any money, but, you know, if you can, of course, you can raise some funds. Great, that is wonderful, but you don't have to do it. At least be there, be physically help us help the animal, coordinate the rescue when we are present, be available there, and also follow up on medicines. We give you some, some medicines that you can, mix in the food and give. Try to give it. So we've brought along the communities together, which is a huge part of our success, and today we are able to touch so many animals. It's because of the communities that have that we have brought along with us to grow along with us, empower them, making them able to carry out those work that we are unable to do, go and do it individually.
Yeah, definitely. And it is a huge amount of work. To that point, we know pretty much globally in a lot of different communities and countries that the animal rescue and protection sector is predominantly taken care of by strong, educated women like yourself. Would you say that is the case across your facility, across the sanctuary, across India and other rescue groups as well?
Yeah, that's something that stands out. I totally agree with you. I mean, I'm not saying that there aren't men and there are very compassionate and kind men. They're part of our organization. And, one of our vets is probably one of the most compassionate individuals, is a male vet who is part of our team, who's, one of the most compassionate individuals I've ever met. It is there. But women in general are the strong force behind, because I also feel that, the whole animal welfare movement and is also very closely connected with the feminist movement, right? I mean, it's if you think about it, there are a lot of parallels. You can draw so many parallels about vulnerability, about, discrimination, about violation of the body. I mean, there is so much in common. So it is not very surprising that there are strong women behind many of these organizations that are very animal centric, and also animal rights movement led by very strong women who feel very strongly about their rights as women, as the most vulnerable, as you see in any society, is women, children and animals. Yeah. So it's a parallel that is there. And I find that all across, not only in India, all across the globe, that is a fact. And there are a lot more women, strong women who are behind these movements.
Just one last question to wrap it up for all those women and men also that listen to us. Any tips for anyone who wants to start getting involved in TNR or, just rescuing animals? Any tips for them?
Yeah. So my tip is that, of course, we all will make mistakes. We do make mistakes. But what I would strongly suggest is to do a lot of homework and, go visit, go learn, equip yourself very well. I'm not saying, in spite of all that, you will not make mistakes. You will still make mistakes, but you can at least reduce some of those, heartbreaking moments where you have really done something with a great intention but has backfired, and so my thing, I mean, there are so much resources now available, and the world has become much shorter. You can learn from anywhere in the world, and you can bring in best practices that are, done in different parts of the world, that to bring it to your own center, and always start small. Many times I find people who are saying, I have this target, I have this thing. Don't have a target. I mean, it's an animal is not a target, right? Do quality work. Always put quality above quantity, and always have the vision of, it's a life that you're dealing with, and, give that importance. It's as precious as your own life. So I think that would be my only, advice.
That's a great advice. That's amazing. Thank you so much for coming on the show, Mini. You've inspired us. You're just incredible, and you're doing such a good work for the animals. So thank you so much.
And thank you so much. And I have great appreciation for Amber and Ollie, who really, facilitated this. I mean, they were wonderful volunteers, and they came at a time when we were desperately, short of people, and they just, jumped in and just did whatever it took to do.
If some people would like to be like Amber and Ollie and come volunteer with you, where can they find you?
Yeah, they can find us. We have our website, hasindia.org, and we have our social media handles. Our Insta handle, hascoimbatore, and our Facebook. I mean, our social media is quite active. Thankfully, we have, you know, not me running social media. I'm very, very pathetic when it comes to doing things like that. But we have young, vibrant, you know, people who are very passionate about putting up their stories, transformations. Please, we would love to have volunteers. And volunteers have really made a big difference to our organization. And like what you are doing today, I mean, it would not have been possible had Ollie and Amber not come and visited us. And so that has made a big difference. Thank you.
Exactly. Thank you so much. And for all of you who are listening to us, we would love to hear about your experience. So send us a DM on either Saving Lives with 2 A's or Travel Animal Rescue on Instagram, and we can have you on the show. We can answer all of your questions. Let's talk about spaying and neutering, and let's save those animals. See you all at our next episode. And in the meantime, stay out of trouble and keep trapping to save the streets one animal at a time.
Let's Talk Pets, every week on demand, only on PetLifeRadio.com.